Greetings, programs, and a happy bonfire night to those of you in the UK. Yes, it's the beginning of the month, and once more, the Cult Classic Show is back to try and take your mind off the fact that you've only got 49 days exactly to get your Christmas shopping in. And if you're not listening to this on the day of release, you've got even less. Those of you coming to it later on, game over, man. Yes, Monster Month may now be over, and we hope you had a wonderful Halloween. But Silver Screen keeps on rolling, and if you hadn't guessed from the opening, or indeed the thumbnail, come on dude, pay attention, then this month, for the penultimate episode of this season, we'll be taking a look at another poster boy for the very definition of cult classic, the 1982 Disney video game epic Tron. So make sure you've got your identity disc with you for this one, as any program found to be without one will be subject to immediate deresolution. As always, I'm DK, your host slash bit on this guide through the space paranoids type maze that will be this show for the next hour and change. Though regular listeners will know that, unfortunately, I don't just limit my responses to a binary response. But as always, I'll not be entering the digital world alone. I'll be joined by a little collection of guests for this one. And first up, we have who is rapidly becoming a semi-regular player too on these things. It's Jen.
Hello.
Once again, good to have you with us. How are you?
I'm good. I'm sleepy.
It's a good start. I understand from the DMs that we've been exchanging that you've been boning up, as it were, on all things Tron. Is that right?
I watched a documentary, watched the movies, watched the series.
In all fairness, that's more effort than Disney execs put in, so I'll allow it. So, yeah. That's not all. We've got another a new guest with us today, kind of, on Cult Classics. He was on Silver Screen Regular Flavor a few months back to discuss Spielberg's Ready Player One. He'll be the third one to join our little light cycle party, the ram to our little group of rebels. It's Mr. Glenn Brooks.
Hello.
And how are things with you, buddy? Excited for this one?
All good. Very excited for this one. Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, I know you've been itching to talk about this. It seems what with this and your debut, you're like constantly in a little virtual world here with us.
Yeah, it's nice. It's comfortable. It's a very welcoming place.
Nice one. So, yeah, without further ado, we'll log on to this one. But as has become tradition here on the show, because technically Glenn is a first-time player on this, we always ask the newbies on Cult Classics a question, partially to gauge where they're coming from, and partially because Mike and I like to imagine we're the gods of Olympus making wagers on anyone that turns up. So, before we go any further, as the resident show virgin, if you had to choose one cult movie, your number one go-to of any genre, what would that be?
Ah, that's put me really on the spot. It would be a film called Simple Men.
What's that? I don't think I've heard of that one. Do you care to share with us what that's about?
It's on Blu-ray. It's called Simple Men. It's on the Artificial Eye label, and it's just an incredible film about two brothers searching for their missing father, who's a terrorist. It's directed by Hal Hartley.
Are there any big names in it, or is it, you know, little known actor kind of?
Big name is Robert John Burke. You might know him from Dust Devil, another cult classic.
Oh yeah. What is it about Simple Men that you admire so much?
It's wacky. It has serious parts, but it also has a dance routine in the middle of it that all the characters take part in. It's just the dialogue, just the acting, just everything about it just screams cult classic. But it's not one of those that you find unapproachable. The characters are like heartwarming, and you identify with everybody and sympathize with everybody. Honestly, if you ever get the chance, Simple Men is just so different.
I will I'll check that out. And as a bonus, we were supposed to have a fourth guest, but fingers crossed, here he is. It's Mr. R.W. Martin. Are you there with us?
I am here. Can you hear me?
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. We can.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, I don't know what was going on, but here I am. So thanks for having me. I'm sorry for all the technical difficulties.
Not a problem. As I was saying to Glenn earlier, it wouldn't be Cult Classics if everything went peachy from the start. You've just come in at just the right time. Because you're a first-time guest to the show, if I had to ask you a question, gun to your head, if you had to choose one cult movie, sort of like a desert island disc that you'd take over anything else, what would that movie be and why?
Well, I mean, we are talking Tron, so I guess I'd have to say Tron. I became a Jeff Bridges fan in 1976 with King Kong. And for a while, that was like one of my favorite movies. It's my third favorite movie right now. And then Tron came out, and it just, everything about that movie just, I don't know, resonated with me in a way that no other movie has. So I would have to say, if I was stuck on a deserted island and I only had one movie to watch every single day, it would be Tron.
Oh, nice one. I should say to the listeners, RW has got the most beautiful, extensive, and I hope he leaves it me in his will, collection of Tron memorabilia that I have ever seen in my life. I mean, this guy has, I'm not going to say has it all, but he's got stuff that you wouldn't believe. I mean, what got you into that, dude?
Yeah, so I'm also an actor and a writer. I live in Vermont, USA, and I'll be 59 this year, and I've been kind of acting ever since I was a kid, acting up more like it. But I've always, as a kid, loved television and movies. And like I say, there's just something about Tron. In 2012, I was able to fly to Hollywood, California to be part of the Tron 30th anniversary. They showed it at the Grauman's Chinese Theater out in Hollywood. I got to meet, you know, Steve Lisberger, who wrote and directed the movie, and a bunch of other people who worked on the movie, Jerry Reese, Daryl Rooney. And I've become friends with these people over the past, you know, 12, 15 years or whatever. And one of them found a box of Tron memorabilia that they had back in 1981, 82, and said, "Hey, I found all this memorabilia. Is it something you would want?" And without hesitating, I said, "Yeah." You know,
yeah.
So I got storyboards, original storyboards, and I got this reel that's a test reel. It's like a 4-minute reel that I'm in the process of having digitized. But I've managed to find another person who was able to steal a few frames so that I could see the photos or whatever. And it's amazing that this person, you know, thought of me to say, "Hey, do you want this stuff?" when they could have picked, you know, any other person in the world. So that's pretty cool. At a couple separate different comic cons, I met Bruce Boxleitner at one and Cindy Morgan, God rest her soul, at another one. And as I was talking to DK, I do have a couple Jeff Bridges autographs, which is pretty cool. But I got really lucky with that. To me, it's just, you know, a movie was never made like that beforehand and will never be made like that again. So that's kind of what makes it special.
Nice one. So yeah, we'll get to discussing the different aspects of the movie shortly, but I'll give a bit of background information for those people out there that's not heard this, and if they've not seen Tron, why the hell are they listening to this? But yeah, Tron is a 1982 American science fiction action adventure film written and directed by Steven Lisberger, from a story by Lisberger and Bonnie McBird. The film stars Jeff Bridges as Kevin Flynn, a computer programmer / video game developer who is transported inside the software world of a computer. It also stars Bruce Boxleitner, David Warner, Cindy Morgan, and Bernard Hughes. The movie is one of cinema's earliest films to use extensive computer-generated imagery. In 1976, animator Steven Lisberger came across a demonstration reel compiled by Magi, a computer firm that was at the forefront of experimenting with graphics software to create optical effects. Lisberger was intrigued, but it wasn't until he saw the early Atari video game Pong that he was convinced a movie set inside a computer-generated world was viable. The idea led to what would become Tron. He and producer Donald Kushner set up an animation studio to develop Tron with the intention of making an animated film. To promote the studio itself, Lisberger and his team created a 30-second animation featuring the first appearance of the title character. Eventually, Lisberger decided to include live-action elements with both backlit and computer animation for the actual feature-length film. Various studios had rejected the storyboards for the film before Walt Disney Production agreed to finance and distribute the movie. Principal photography began April 20th, 1981 in Los Angeles, and they were completed in July 1981 with post-production completed by spring 82. It was originally scheduled to release in Christmas of that year, but was rescheduled when Disney found out that animator Don Bluth, who had defected from the company in 1979, had publicly called Disney stale. Bluth was set to release his Secret of Nim feature in July, so Disney had the release date for Tron moved up to July the 9th in the hopes it would crush Bluth's project. Nim made $40 million while Tron delivered $33 million. However, neither was considered a hit. In fact, the poor return at the box office caused Disney to re-release Tron in February of 83, which produced even worse results. It received mixed to negative reviews from critics, who praised its groundbreaking visuals and acting, but criticised its storyline as being incoherent. It received nominations for Best Costume Design and Best Sound at the 55th Academy Awards. It was, however, disqualified from the Best Visual Effects category, as the board felt the CGI was cheating. How times change. However, it did spawn multiple video games. Over the years, it's garnered a huge and passionate cult following. Looks around everybody here today. Leading to numerous tie-in books, video games, action figures, sequel, spin-off cartoon series, a further sequel with development, Tron Ares, is currently in production. And Tron can currently be found at Disney Plus, as well as other streaming platforms, as always dependent on your location, as well as physical formats, DVD and Blu-ray.
Yeah, I had the pleasure of talking to the visual effects director on Tron, Mr. Jerry Reese. He's also a writer and a director, to ask him a couple of questions regarding this movie. So I'll take us right over to that.
We were leaning into the discovery and the adventure, and every day we were trying to problem solve. So many times, you know, we wouldn't be able to think ahead about the context or historically exactly how it fit. But we'd be just thinking about that day, what to do. So we'd go, okay, I storyboarded this thing where it's like Flynn jumps into, he jumps into the beam and it's going to take out the MCP. And, there's like the moment they kiss, and I had storyboarded it so the beam would be behind them during the kiss. And now that he dives in, I'd be over it, like at III with Richard Taylor, and they go, well, he's supposed to be inside the beam, but if we put him inside the beam, he'll just disappear because there's no transparency. It's just an opaque cylinder thing. And if we put him inside, he disappears. So it's like, well, okay, he'll have to be on the camera side and not inside the beam. And like, well, what can we do to make it look like he's inside of it? So we did sort of thinking of different things. And I said, well, can you make his body so that as the camera is sending the rays in your ray tracing, as the surface gets more and more off of perpendicular and to be parallel to the beam, as it tilts more and more, could you have it become more and more transparent or more and more of a different color? And they're like, we could have it become more and more of a different color as it moves. So I'm like, okay, well, let's have it take on the same color of the cylinder as it moves through the edges of him. So they're like, okay. And so they were like, take the rays, measure perpendicular to parallel, have it map different colorations. And then we're like, okay, solve that problem. That's now a thing. So it's like, it kind of works. And now you look at it and go, well, it's clunky and it only a little bit worked, but at least it got us past a glaringly bad problem. And so every day we were doing that kind of just figure it out today. There's no program for any of this. And I was doing things like, you know, we were working on systems that had no, there was no mouse in that day. So I would have to be with a technician that was typing a bunch of instructions in even to get a vector line still of a situation. And so I would have the storyboards mapped out and we would guess like, okay, we're looking at the carrier and we've got the solar sailor in front of it and that's supposed to look dwarfed by this giant thing. So let's get back and have the camera look at it. And we guess at how, what kind of lens, and you try it and go like, oh, the solar sailor looks way too big. It's like the carrier looks tiny and the solar sailor looks completely giant. It's like, that's not that story. So I'd go, okay, back the camera way the hell up and make it a long lens. So make it this kind of a lens choice. And so then they re-render it and it would take like 20 minutes to render one frame up just in vector line. You go, okay, that's working better. Now that we backed the camera up, we're doing long lens. Now it makes the solar sailor look small. And so, you know, I was guiding the computer programmers through what it means to make cinematic choices and thinking about how do you take something that's just artist drawn on a storyboard and try to figure out what that is inside of the space that's inside of the CG world before there was such a thing as any sort of programs to guide it, where you're just doing it a frame at a time and you're basically just doing stop motion of one frame at a time inside of a CG environment before there's movement programs. So we were just deeply into all of that stuff and we would just cheer every time there was a breakthrough and we'd survive something and it would look the way we hoped it would look and it told the story we hoped it would tell. So that's really our focus. And we were so grappling with this every day in such a handcrafted way that the biggest shock to us was that while that was our daily life was just like going down and doing stop motion and then doing math that you would send to people to even get the effect of a force field. When we went to the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, they didn't understand that that was our life. They thought we pushed a button and the computer did the whole thing for us. And we were sitting there crafting every friggin' frame. And they're like, oh, the computer made the movie and now you're taking credit for it. It's like, no, we carefully crafted every goddamn frame. It's like,
yeah, that was Jerry Rees, visual effects director on Tron, and a genuinely nice guy. I had a fantastic time talking to him. So if you want to see more of that interview in which he discusses more with regards to Tron, as well as his work at Disney and his work on directing The Brave Little Toaster, then by all means, check out the full interview. And I guarantee it's fascinating, absolutely fascinating. But so please check it out. It's in the description below this one.
Now, normally I've got some sort of convoluted story to tell about my first experience with the movie in question, but this one is relatively straightforward. I've always been a video gamer, so when this one showed up at the Odeon in that pokey little town where I lived, my mother took me to see it, and that's pretty much it. I picked up one of those little poster magazines in the foyer they used to produce for movies, and it was on my wall as soon as we got home. I loved the movie then, and I love it now. It's never faded for me. So how about you guys? What were your first experiences of this one? I mean, have you got any fond memories associated with it? I'll come to you first on this one, Jen.
I had never seen the original when the new one came out, because the original came out before I was born. I saw the second one when I was working at Disneyland. So there was a lot of hype going on about it. We had the whole little Flynn arcade and this like party thing that would go on three nights a week. That was like a rave or something. It was a lot of fun. And I loved the music because I'm a big Daft Punk fan. So I watched the original at some point when I finally was able to get a hold of it. And here we are.
Nice one. What about you, Glenn?
I went to see it on release at the cinema because I am that old. I was a little teenager at the time. I'd been following it in Starlog and Starburst, and I got really hyped for it. But my little teen brain could not understand, because I was a big Jeff Bridges fan. He did a film with Clint Eastwood called Thunderbolt and Lightfoot. And I've been following his career since then. And I couldn't understand why he wasn't the hero. he wasn't Tron. For my little teenage brain, I couldn't quite understand. I'm this, like, big Jeff Bridges fan, and he's not the star of the movie. He's not Tron. So it took a while to kind of like assimilate that he wasn't, you know, the lead character. But just fell in love with it. The visuals, obviously the light cycle, that could win practically anybody over. And just loved it ever since.
Nice one. What about you, IW? When did you first see this?
I'm pretty sure I first saw it in theaters, but just to come off what he just said, although Bruce Boxleitner is Tron, in my opinion, it's Jeff's movie. Like, Jeff is really... If you really think about it, Jeff really is the lead and he really is the hero because he's the one who gets in there to make everything work. And then at the end, dives into the MCP cone so that Tron can like do his thing. So if Jeff or, you know, Flynn hadn't done that. So technically, really, if you think about it, Flynn really is the hero and not Tron. I mean, that's just my opinion.
The story is more about Flynn's journey.
Yeah, I can see that now. But then when I was, I don't even know how old I was, 12 or, you know, then brain being kind of simplistically geared up to just see heroes, villains, and I didn't get the subtle idea that he was the push for the film, the kind of like thing that instigated everything. But it was just that, but you know, he's the star. He's Jeff Bridges. Why isn't he?
Yeah.
But I was, you know, I was so young then that I couldn't quite grasp why he wasn't.
A lot of people don't know that actually, and maybe somebody knows this, but Jeff Bridges wasn't technically the first person they thought of to play Flynn. Do you guys have heard this story?
I did not know that. No, I did not know that.
Robin Williams was who they were originally thinking of Flynn. I think... As much as I love Robin, I just think he would have probably been way over the top more than Jeff. And I think Jeff, you know, played it. My favorite line is because, man, somewhere in one of these memories is the evidence. If I could get in far enough, I can reconstruct it. But yeah, I've always loved Jeff Bridges. I think he did a heck of a job in King Kong. I mean, he's the dude, man. I'm the dude. That's what you call me. Like,
I was going to say, I think the character fits his like natural personality a lot better than it would have Robin Williams.
It was just like you believe that he was this guy. He's like, they're plugging all these quarters in. I don't see a dime except for what I scrape out of here. You know, like it's just, he seemed genuine. Like, you know, you watch some actors and you go, these people are actors, but you watch Jeff and you believe that he's that person. Like, you don't go, he's just acting. It's like, wow, he becomes whoever it is he's doing. And like, you believe Flynn was this guy who got ripped off and now runs this crappy arcade or whatever, you know.
Well, I mean, to inspire the actors, apparently they placed arcade machines on the production sets that they could be played during downtime. And apparently Bridges was the most addicted to these games, and they found it hard to get him away from them in order to get him to shoot a scene. And I loved that about this. He, as you say, RW, he does kind of embody Kevin Flynn. So, yeah, it brings us, you know, in a roundabout kind of way to the title character himself, Tron, Bruce Boxleitner. What were your thoughts with regards to that character?
I said to DK earlier, I do love his corduroy jacket, his sunglasses and corduroy jacket. The guy's looking cool.
Apparently the character of Alan Bradley, he was based in part on Alan Kay, the creator of Dynabook, and along with the Stanford AI lab. The lab in the film was based on Kay's lab at Xerox Park, and it was Mac Bird's suggestion to Lisberger that they get Alan Kay as a consultant on the film that they were developing. And Kay and McBird, they actually married later on in 83. Aww. So, yeah.
But I don't know. I don't know if anybody else could have played it the way, you know, and it's weird because we get so used to watching somebody as something. And then you go, well, Robin Williams was supposed to play, you know, Flynn. Oh, that would have never worked. But if we only knew Robin Williams as Flynn, then it would have worked because that's all we would have known. So it's hard to say, I don't think, you know, Bruce was a good Tron. I don't think Jeff was a good Flint, because we don't really have any other thing to compare it to. So as far as we're like, no, Bruce is the only one that could have played Tron, and Cindy's the only one that could have played Yori, and we get that, but we don't know, you know, because I think Kurt Russell tried out for Han Solo, yeah, or whatever. So, you know, Kurt Russell couldn't have done it, but he probably could have, you know. We just get so accustomed to who we've seen in these roles that we can't picture anybody else in that role.
I think he does have the best line in the whole movie, but he says that Master Control has more bugs than a bait store.
Oh yeah, the system's got more bugs than a bait store. Yeah. Oh my God, I do love that.
I met Bruce a couple of years ago, and he saw me. He looked me up and down, and he said, "Babylon 5 or Tron?" and I was just like, dude, it's everything. It's Tron, it's B5, it's Scarecrow, Mrs. King, it's Bring Him Back Alive. But yeah, let's talk about Tron. And he was such a nice guy. And they always say, you know, never meet your heroes. And I'm guessing, you know, you've experienced this yourself, RW. They say never meet your heroes. But he's one of those people that I met him and I came away genuinely blown away. I was smiling for like days afterwards, because they only gave him something like 2 minutes with each person, and he ended up spending about 20 minutes talking to me, and I just felt like king of the world, you know. I came away thinking I've just been speaking to Tron.
But I think we could all probably agree with if we, any of us, ever met Jeff Bridges, we would probably be running that high for like the rest of our lives, because he is just Jeff Bridges, you know.
Yeah, I think he's one of those actors that I don't know anybody that's genuinely got a bad word to say about him. He seems universally respected.
Just everything he does is gold, you know. And I mean, you got your Lebowski fans who just they put that at the top of their Jeff Bridges list. And you know, like I say, Tron is my second favorite movie of all time, and King Kong is my third favorite movie of all time. So, two Jeff Bridges movies in the top five right there.
I'm going to, you know, people are going to write in and demand I be flogged. What's your first?
It's a little movie that was actually being written while they were filming it, with this little unknown star that nobody's ever heard of. His name is Jimmy Stewart, and it's called It's a Wonderful Life. Yeah, so nothing can top that movie. I mean, it's a movie about a guy who's giving up and thinks that his life wasn't worth anything. And I think all of us in some way every day go, is what I'm doing even worth anything? Am I making a difference to anybody? And this guy's like, I'm done. And then he gets shown how many lives he has touched and what the world would have been like had he not been around to do all that stuff. And it just hits you in the feels every time I watch it. So it has to be number one. Like, I cry at the end every single time.
Exactly, dude. Going on to Cindy Morgan, did you say you'd met Cindy?
Oh, my gosh. So she was at a con, and I go over and I go, I've already got your autograph. I was just wondering if I could get a selfie with you. And she goes, what are you going to do for me? I'm like, what do you want me to do for you? And so Larry Wilcox, if you know who Larry Wilcox from the TV show Chips, the motorcycle cops.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
So he was like one table over, and she goes, okay, I'll give you this selfie, but you got to do something for me. And I'm like, okay. And I was dressed as a California Highway Patrol officer at this con. So she goes, I need you to go over there and handcuff Larry. And I go, what? She goes, I owe him. You need to go over there, and you need to handcuff him and say he's under arrest. And I'm going, I know Larry, but I don't know if I know him enough to go over there and slap handcuffs on the guy or whatever, right? So I go over and I kind of whisper in Larry's ear. I go, hey, Cindy wants me to put these handcuffs on you. Says she owes you for something, so can I put these handcuffs on you? And he goes, okay. So then there was a security guard there. So we both grab him, and I put handcuffs on him, and Cindy's over at her desk going, I got you back, or whatever. And so then she took the selfies with me or whatever, and she was wicked cool. But, like, it was just so funny that she wanted me to handcuff Larry Wilcox. I'm like, if it gets me a selfie, I'll go do it, I guess, you know. But, yeah, she was very sweet.
Nice one. Well, apparently, according to my research, several actresses tested for the role of Yuri and Laurie, but they were often scared away by the costume, which, you know, obviously was basically a helmet and spandex. Apparently Debbie Harry tried out, but she wasn't cast, and Cindy Morgan was brought in only days before her first scene was shot. And according to I think it was Comic Con Quest 2010, she apparently traded her Yuri costume in the end for a Lexus.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, I guess the jock strap things or whatever they had to wear underneath were not
pants
really
belts.
Comfortable. Yeah, there yeah. you go.
Put down.
They apparently they were asked by everybody else in the commissary that when they went to wear robes, when they went to go eat, because it was leaving a little too much to the imagination when they went to go and sit down amongst everybody else. And apparently, you know, we're going back to Bridges again. He was apparently the biggest star to wear these to wear this thing.
Wow. Oh my God. But, yeah, I mean, it just, I don't know, again, what it is about that movie. And I think the reds and the blues, even though those were all hand-painted, now that we find that out, to me just was, there was nothing visually really like it until then. I mean, obviously Star Wars had come out before and you had lightsabers and stuff, but to go inside a computer and it just, it was kind of cool. Like, and you got Peter Jurasik and Daniel Shore playing Rom and Ram and all that.
See,
stuff.
I didn't put it in, I didn't put two and two together until the other day that he was Billy the Kid in Bill and Ted.
Yeah. And then what's funny is both Peter Jurasik and Bruce went on to go to Babylon 5 at the same time.
And David whatever. Warner made an appearance in that as well.
David was on everything. Star Trek.
He was been both Final Frontier and Undiscovered Country. He was in Twin Peaks. He was in Doctor. Yeah. The dude was in everything. He's in one of my favorite movies as well, Time After Time. I don't know if you guys have seen that one.
Oh, yeah.
The Jack the Ripper one.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think he plays a blinder in that one. And Bernard Hughes, who I remember, I mean, yeah, everybody remembers him from Lost Boys, but I remember him, I don't know if any of you guys, you might remember this one, Glenn. He was in a TV show back in the day called Mr. Merlin.
Of course, I just about, I don't know, maybe a year ago, I found Mr. Merlin on some free channel and I watched them all because it had been a long time. And that wasn't a bad show, but I always liked him. Like, he was just, you know, one of those actors that you saw and was like, oh, hey, it's Barnard Hughes or whatever, you know?
This is for anybody that used to rent videos in the 80s. I was going down the cast, and again, don't quote me, and an actor is playing the conscript number two, Michael Dudikoff. And he went on to appear in the American Ninja video series.
Oh, God, yeah.
And one of the stuntmen was, I had his name, but he ended up being the stunt double for Mr. T on the A-Team. So, and then Jackson Bostwick, who played the original Shazam, was one of the guards.
Yeah.
So, like, these people who were really I wouldn't say nobody, because that's not a good word to use, but they weren't known, did Tron, and then they went on to, do other things, which is pretty wild, you know?
I do have to say this. David Warner, I love Warner in this, but apparently Peter O'Toole was approached to play Dillinger and Sark, but after reading the script, he wanted to play Tron. And during a meeting with Lisberger at the Beverly Wiltshire, O'Toole jumped on the furniture and declared, "I can do this!" And then he claimed he wanted Tron on his tombstone right next to Lawrence of Arabia. And I just, you know, that's another Robin Williams thing. I just cannot imagine. I'd love to see a version. But, I mean, with regards to with who we ended up with, you know, obviously Bridges, Box Lightner, Warner, et al. I mean, is there a standout for each of you in this, and is there anybody that we may not have mentioned that you want to draw attention to? And I'll come to you first, Jen.
I liked the cast. Even the loss of the character Ram was sad. Okay, I would have liked seeing maybe 5% more of it.
Yes.
Yeah. He just kind of came. did his little shtick, and then it was over.
Yeah. It was a cute little, like, side character relief thing, but it's like, I would like to see just a tiny bit more. But, you know, it's like, how much can you really do with a binary character that can only say yes or no?
That's fair enough. What about you, Glenn?
Just Jeff Bridges again. And we come back to Jeff Bridges. unfortunately, you can't escape the fact that he just holds your attention every time. Anytime he's on screen, you can really only concentrate on Jeff Bridges. It does some of the weirdest kind of, like, when he's sneaking into the factory, he does the weirdest walk.
I love that, when he's, like, doing the tiptoeing across the floor. I love that. It's so cartoon-like.
He probably came up with that. I mean, nobody's going to know he's there because he's walking so strangely, so you can't see him. He's invisible. And the music just kind of, like, plays along to the way he's walking.
Yes. My editor, Nick, he mentioned that. He says, my favourite was possibly when they're sneaking into NCOM, and they actually do the cartoon tiptoe sneak run to avoid the guards.
He says,
I do have to read this out from Nick as well. You know, he says, also, Alan and Laura agree to some massive, massive corporate espionage awfully quickly. He says, they just didn't mess around then. Let's move the plot to where everyone wants it to be, and let's just not worry too much about it.
I love that about the film. That's one of my... There's no big expedition dumps.
No.
They tell you... There's no backstory because they tell you that Flynn and Laurie had a relationship within one line as they're going into the arcade.
Yep.
They just move everything.
It's like, what
so
did you ever
smoothly.
See in him?
I do oh, like yeah. that. Does she still leave her clothes all over the floor? And she goes, no. And she goes, Alan. And he goes, well, not that often.
Yeah.
It just flows. It's beautiful. The way it's kinetic, it just keeps moving forward. All the information's
they
there.
They did great chemistry between the characters and just set it up and everything. It worked well. I think the fact that they had to take so long in making it made it nice and give them plenty of time for any editing as well.
But as you say, it's the storytelling was pretty economic. They get from A to B rather quickly because they know what the audience, as Nick says in his, you know, little thing I've just read out, they know what the audiences want and they want to get there as quickly as possible and they give it what they want. And I do like that with regards to the writing. And I think Liz Berger and McBird, who, you know, I've got to shout out, she was obviously a computer programmer herself, did some really good writing with regards to this. I know it's not to everybody's taste, and I know it's probably nostalgia and rose-tinted spectacles looking back, but I love it. As you say, they're not going around the houses in order to get to where they need to be. And I also, I do love the fact that the discs was an intentional choice on the part of Liz Berger. He wanted to kind of distance the film from any violent imagery for kids emulating at home. So he figured the worst they could do was like beam themselves in the head with a frisbee.
Yep.
Right. So there was a frisbee champion that lived out in, I believe it was in California. His name is Sam Schatz. Schatz, and he was a frisbee champion. So he showed other people how to like throw the frisbee and make it look real. Here's the money question: when the solar sailor is going across, you see Mickey Mouse on the grid. How long did it take? How long did it take you guys to notice that?
It was only a couple of times for me for that one.
I did notice the little Pac-Man on the when it starts in the cruiser. The actual map. There's a little Pac-Man doing his Pac, and they can hear the sound, Pac-Man sound effect.
Apparently, the recognizers, they were modelled after a hunched-over Donkey Kong from the original arcade machine as well.
Oh. Really?
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah, there's that scene where Flynn's recognizer basically falls into pieces and he kind of stumbles out. Like, some people are missing arms and legs because of the way they, you know, green-screened or black-screened it or whatever. But, you know, black screen. It's a computer world, and like Richard Taylor says, anytime something glitched in the computer world, it was just a glitch. It was the computer world. So it all, you know, it's not like, oh, you messed up here. No, we meant to do that.
I mean, the commentary, it says there was virtually no camera movement whatsoever in any shots of the electronic world with live action characters. They brought in a camera on a tripod and literally nailed the camera to the floor. It was so locked off that they commented that it wouldn't move even if it was hit by a car.
Wow.
Yeah, it's the few shots with live action characters which actually have camera movement, which is only about a dozen shots in all, involve very, very simple graphics or animation, such as, you know, one color backlighting.
So you want to know why they had to do it on a black screen?
Go for it.
The reason they were originally doing test things with white all around, and then they're like, there are not enough lights in Hollywood to light a white set. So they had to do it on a black screen, which ended up working out great. I think if they had done it on a white screen, a lot of the stuff they ended up doing to make the lines light up and everything wouldn't have worked as well
with
white.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, I mean, at that point, technology, it literally didn't exist for a shot to contain both live actors and CGI. So, I mean, they got around it with hand-drawn animation and just basically editing, such as the light cycle chase. So you look at them now, and even though they look good, there's very little CGI and live action taking place at the same time.
Yeah.
And Disney, I mean, Disney animators were reluctant, and in some cases, you know, they outright refused to work on the movie because they feared that computer animation would eventually put them out of the job. I mean, in fairness, I mean, it took longer than expected, but they were kind of correct.
I mean, if it wasn't for Tron and The Last Starfighter, which followed with CGI, there wouldn't be Jurassic Park or any of this other stuff, really, because they had to start somewhere.
Well, exactly. John Lasseter, he was a storyboard artist at Disney when Tron was in development. And after catching a glimpse of the production, he convinced the studio to let him do a 30-second test reel featuring CGI backgrounds. They liked it, but at the time they were more interested in, you know, saving money. But Lasseter wasn't discouraged. He says, "It absolutely blew me away what we could do." And he says, "A little door in my mind opened up. I looked at it and said, this is it. This is the future." And, you know, he was right, as it were. Blitzberger needed a computer that used just 2 meg of memory and 330 meg of hard drive storage space. And that's all they used for the CG in this. I have to also give a shout out to Sid Mead and Jean Mobius Girard, because their designs were just stunning for this.
Yeah. But it's amazing, you know, where we've come because of that movie and stuff.
Definitely. Going on to that, we'll come back to the sound design in a moment, but taking a look at the legacy. Due to the poor return at the box office following this film and its live-action predecessor, The Black Hole at Disney, which were in 1979, Disney Studios, they didn't make another live-action movie for 10 years. But while the film was a commercial failure, the video games, arcade machines based on it, they actually outgrossed the film. And I remember for the longest time, when nobody wanted to touch this franchise with a barge pole, it was just kind of there. Disney kind of saw it as this little bit of an embarrassment, and they brushed it aside. And to me, it wasn't until the late 90s, and they brought out, I don't know if any of you guys played it, they brought out Tron 2.0, the PC game.
Yep, I had it on Xbox, I think.
Yeah,
there was a lot of stuff going on in the late 90s of, like, you were still getting the cyberpunk stuff coming out. It was kind of like a cultural thing coming back around. And so Tron was at the beginning of all of this video game stuff.
Yeah. I remember the PC game selling really well, and they brought out a range of action figures for it and all that kind of stuff. But I came to the game a little late, so I missed all of that. But then apparently it kicked off Disney's interest, thinking, oh, people actually care about this franchise. So they started looking at doing a sequel. The Matrix had been released not long before. So they were going down the route of maybe doing a kind of Matrix-style movie for the sequel. And that's when Joseph Kaczynski got involved and said, no, you should not be doing this. And so they put together, he put together a proof of concept trailer. And yeah, he showed it, yeah. He showed that to Disney, and Disney just went, okay, we want that. We want that. We'll, yeah, we'll take that. So yeah, then they went kind of full steam ahead. And at that point, you had Tron Uprising, the series that, you know, you've been watching, Jen. They had Tron Evolution, the game. I don't know if any of you guys played that.
Yep.
Yeah. They had they released a graphic novel, Tron Betrayal. One thing that I haven't mentioned, but I've just got it because I just get a kick out of this. Tron mega fan, Jay Maynard. Do you guys remember that?
God, the Tron guy?
Tron guy, yeah.
Yeah.
When they released Tron Legacy back in 2010, people were just obsessed for what his opinion was on the movie. The only problem was that when he went to see it, he got kicked out of the theatre because they decided that his wardrobe was too distracting for the other cinema goers.
Oh, no.
So he never actually saw the film straight away.
He won up Jeff in his outfit.
Oh, God, yeah. Oh,
gosh.
So Jeff was no longer the big man on campus Jay was, I guess.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, God. So before we move forward, the one thing that we've not discussed is the soundtrack, the sound design and the soundtrack, which I just think is just chef's kiss in this case. I mean, you've got Wendy Carlos from, you know, Clockwork Orange, The Shining. You've got Journey. I just think it, as a time capsule of the era, I just think it's perfect. I just wondered what you guys thought to that.
I always love that music. Of course, it's great.
Oh, it fitted the film perfectly. It just emphasizes all the dramatic moments. It's quiet when it needs to be, loud when it needs to be. It's a great score. Really is.
And it doesn't like blast your eardrums like the second movie does, because for whatever reason they film movies that have the soundtrack and everything is way louder than everything else.
It's got to fill that cinema.
I will be honest, and anybody that listens to Silver Screen in general over the years will know I have a big thing for, you know, certain soundtracks. I will say that the soundtrack for Tron, it has never, and I mean never, been off my player of choice since it was first released. I mean, admittedly, it was on cassette, recorded from a vinyl for many years, because apparently the CD was unavailable. Apparently there was such a severe degradation of the original tapes. But by the time of the film's 20th anniversary, they'd finally developed techniques which allowed the tapes to be restored. So they managed to digitally remaster them. But yeah, it's been one of those that has never, ever left my player. But, you know, as I say, from a dodgy cassette all the way up to now, it's still on my phone. All the Tron soundtracks are on my phone, and I just love them. I just love them. Especially for this one, the lightsaber tracks and the ending titles. I just think it gets me every time. So is there anything you, I was going to ask everyone, but is there anything you yourself, Glenn, want to draw attention to? Something that perhaps you think we might have missed?
No, it's just lots of little small things that just make it such a good film. You know, little Easter eggs, little bursts of dialogue that probably Bridges may have improvised. He gets caught by the guards and they're hitting him with the electronic prod. And he just comes out with, hey, if this is about those parking tickets, I can't explain. There's lots of little things he drops in like that, whether it was written or he had lived it. It just makes it work.
Yeah. Even little lines like that. Now, that is a big door.
It just gives the character depth. It's a throwaway line, but it just fits his character so well. He's in this serious situation, yet he's still lighthearted. He's still just joking.
Yeah.
Death could be just around the corner, yet he's throwing out one-liners.
Yeah. Despite its lackluster performance at the box office, it's now regarded as a cult classic. Do you personally think it deserves that label? And why do you think it's gained that notoriety from audiences over the years?
I think, again, it's just timing. Whether the conditions were wrong or people weren't ready for it, sometimes they release a film and nobody's willing to accept it. Then, over time, it's just embraced by a certain small part of the fandom. And then it grows because they'll show their children or they'll show their friends, and it slowly starts to snowball into something that becomes a cult classic. It may start off as a failure, like Blade Runner. Blade Runner started off as a complete financial failure. But over time, given time, it becomes something that most people that have any interest in movies know about light cycles. It's yeah. such an iconic vehicle, an iconic scene, that you can't separate light cycles from Tron.
Yeah, and I'll ask you again, RW. Despite, you know, its lackluster performance, it is now regarded as a cult classic. Do you personally think it deserves that label, and why do you think it's gained notoriety from audiences over the years?
Well, I mean, I think it definitely deserves that because it was groundbreaking, and you know, it without that, and I mean, there's some pretty bad movies out there today, and unfortunately, we owe that to Tron because you know they did the CGI thing and now everybody relies on it. And again, as I had said earlier, I think CGI should help. I think you need a good story, like It's a Wonderful Life. That's a great story. And if they had CGI back in the day to make that movie, you know, better, then great. But don't use CGI to make a movie. Use a good storyline and CGI to enhance that experience, like mm-hmm. with Mandalorian and Fallout and all these other shows that are coming out. If you don't have a good story and you don't have good characters, and I think when we try to just write a movie and see how many cars we can roll over 100,000 times or mm-hmm. how many things we can blow up, that's not a story. That's just visually cool. But we need a story, and Tron had a story to tell, and I think that's why it's endearing. I think that's why it's lasted so long, because it actually has a story to tell, and I do believe that it does deserve cult status. You know, there's a bunch of movies like that. Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai, Megaforce. There's a bunch of shows that didn't do good at first, but then people rediscover them.
And how about you, Jen?
I definitely think it has earned its title. I think it's gotten more noticed because more people play video games now. It's more of an accepted culture. The community has definitely grown, the ability to even just talk to one another. So people are able to relate to it more than they did when it first came out. And, you know, when it first came out, person that played video games was kind of looked down on. So it's kind of more of a cool thing to do. It's, you know, people can openly say, hey, I like this.
Nice. What is it for you personally that does it? With regards to this film, what is it that gives you goosebumps, so to speak? I mean, and this could be anything from a technical point of view to something more personal. What grabs you on this one? I'll ask you first, RW.
Okay. I mean, again, Jeff Bridges, you know, been a fan since 76. But I just think everybody, as we've already discussed, everybody did what they needed to do the way they needed to do it. Like Barnard Hughes. Ah, did you hear what you just said? You said, here goes nothing. But what we actually plan to do is take something, turn it into nothing, and turn it into something again. Yeah. So you might as well have said, you know, like just
the orange.
That whole character, you know, everybody knew what they needed to do. But Jeff Bridges fan, you know, loved Bruce's performance, loved, you know, supporting characters. Like, you think you're just going to blow me away, don't you? You know, when they did the thing. And then you can see that Flynn's like, No, I won't play this game because he's not going to kill this guy, because that's just showing he's got compassion and he's not going to wipe this guy out. And then Sark wipes him out anyway. Just those little pieces of acting that people, you know, did that weren't huge contributed to what we saw. And like when Ram dies, you know, you're like, oh, my God, Ram's dying. And, you know, and what's weird is why couldn't Jeff save him if he was. If he was a programmer, why couldn't he save Ram? And that's the one thing in that movie that I never understood. He can fix the recognizer. He can do all this other stuff, but he couldn't save Ram.
Yeah. Nice one. What about you, Glenn?
Like RW just said, Bridges' just charismatic performance. You can't help but like Flynn. It's his enthusiasm. He's in a life or death situation, and he's still throwing out one-liners. He's still got that absolute, you know, he's in his own, almost he's in his own creation. But it only takes him milliseconds to kind of like understand where he is and just get on with it. And of course, all the design work. I mean, DK knows I love design work. The tanks, the light cycles, Sark's carrier, just the look. It's beautiful. And the pace is perfect. It doesn't slow down. It doesn't sit there and say, well, this is happening, or this character's doing this because. It just, as it, RW said, it does its job, and it does it beautifully, streamlined.
Yeah.
And of course, there's Godzilla Sark at the end.
I mean, yeah.
Is this Godzilla-sized Sark stomping around? It's
just, I do have to say, that's what gave it, in the end, its PG rating. When Tron hit him in the head, it's Lisberger claims this is the shot that gave the movie its PG rating. He says at any time you have brain spilled, electronic or not, that's going to send the rating up. So
and when I was talking to my buddies who made Tron, they said those were all clock pieces that they found that they used for the inside of his head or whatever. So that's pretty cool.
That is awesome.
You know, it's a good story. I like the designs that they chose for it, and how they filmed it is really interesting. The doing the black and white, and then having to do the shifts and adding the color. It's just really cool seeing it as this technological marvel of filming at its time, and it's an entertaining story. Jeff Bridges playing Flynn is fantastic. I love it.
Nice one. I've got to mirror what you guys said. Everything about this. I mean, you've got movies like Ready Player One that may want to take the crown, the video game crown in recent years. But as a young gamer, this was the world I wanted to play in. And it still holds true through the movie when I watch it now, the spin-off media, the performances. They make you believe in it. They're incredibly personable. And the look of it, even now, I know it's very dated to modern audiences probably, but to me, it's just chef's kiss. Whenever I listen to that Carlos soundtrack, I am instantly transported back. So just everything about this just grabs me and just holds on. So that's us, but what about you out there? What did you think to this one? We asked you guys on our socials to give us your opinions, and you answered our call once more. So I'm going to head over to Vian to hear your thoughts. Vian, what did the audience think of this one? What did you think of this one, for that matter?
Hey, DK. So looks like there was actually some pretty spirited debate in the comments about Tron. I personally first became aware of it during what some of you might know is the one of, I won't say the greatest, but one of the greatest Treehouse of Horror episodes of all time, where from The Simpsons, of course, their Halloween specials, where Homer goes into sort of a 3D dimension. And it's kind of like, has anybody seen that movie Tron? So that was my introduction to Tron. And I still haven't seen the whole movie. I've seen bits and pieces here, but I've seen enough of it referenced in pop culture to have an idea about it. But it looks like people either really like this one or really don't. And there's a little middle ground here. But Rick Cowling says, seminal and genre-defining? Yeah, I'd say so. But at the same time, it does appear more than a little bit dated now. I still have a fondness for it, though. A great soundtrack as well. That was something a couple people touched on, was that it has a really good soundtrack, and I'm a sucker for a good soundtrack, so I might have to check that out. Let's see. Douglas R. Reynolds. Yeah, it's a genre-defining movie, and compared to today's CGI, it's very much dated. But I think that's its charm, too. I watched it on Disney Plus 2 years ago, and the story is a solid story. Entertaining, not hokey like a movie like that can be. Solid soundtrack. The acting is great from a cast at the time was relatively unknown. I don't know if Tron is in my top 10 sci-fi movies, but it's in my top 20. And then we have a couple of little comments here. Paul Whittleton, watched it at the cinema, never been a fan myself, so would give it 2 out of 5 stars. While Andrew Dockrell, 4 out of 5, still a great film. Mark Lowens, I remember my dad taking me to see this, loved it then, still love it now, 5 out of 5. Tanis Fenrir Harkonnen, 5 out of 5, such a great film. Arnold Brun, still excellent. John McDonald, still love it, 5 out of 5. Ryan Young loved the sequel despite the uneven reviews. So something to think about there, people even chiming in on the sequel. Alex Clinch, who is one of our top contributors, I saw this at the cinema when it first came out, a great concept that I have watched a couple of times since, as I wondered if my thoughts on the film would change. Sadly, they have not. Great concept, but poor script overall. Could have been a classic, but it's hard work and quite dull. Really wanted to love it, but 3 out of 5 in my opinion. Sequel was also poor. Hoping this new one is much better, as this really is a great concept and the bikes were class. I have to say, from what little I've seen of Tron, this is me personally, from what little I've seen of Tron, those bikes are pretty badass. And then Gavin Revitt, a fun film, truly original and significantly ambitious at the time. I know what Rick and Douglas mean, but there's a singularly unique quality about the Tron series which prevents it from being dated when we speak in the realm of effects. Since the premise is that of a world inside the computer, the effects for that world are consistent with the technology of the time in which a given story is set. Thus, the world of Tron in 1982 looks as appropriate to its time as a historical documentary looks to our eyes, as does the realm of Tron Legacy. I don't know if I agree with that. I mean, I get what he's saying, but I can't say I 100% agree. But personally, I don't always have a problem with dated effects, especially if we're talking about practical effects, which I think tend to age better in general. I do think when I see clips of it that it's very obviously a product of its time, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. Let's see. Tom Sue and another top contributor. Greetings, program. First of all, let's get the obvious out of the way. Light cycles. My thoughts are very much based on nostalgia and probably seen through rose-tinted glasses. Always good when people recognize that. Back then, it was something we've never seen before, and it was unusual for Disney to release such a dark feature film. Special mention must go to David Warner's performance as Stark Dillinger. Oh, see, now I'm sold. I love David Warner. I'm gonna have to go back and watch it. Tom continues. The music and sound effects are spot on. Because it was produced in the infancy of CGI, the effects haven't dated that well, but there are some memorable phrases. See you all on the game grid. End of line. And then Christopher Page finishes us off. In its day, this was something that no one had seen before. In the 1980s, it would easily be a 5 out of 5, but as time has passed, it obviously doesn't hold up. The story is okay. The acting is okay. It's still a fun movie and I enjoy it plenty, but much of that enjoyment is due to the fact that I know it was a first of its kind. In 2024, I'll give it a solid 3.5 out of 5. So I think we kind of have a lot of different perspectives on this, and it seems to me that the people who are really ranking it highly are doing so out of a nostalgia factor rather than it really being groundbreaking or being, well, maybe it is groundbreaking, but hasn't held up as much as others in a similar genre have done. So, love to hear what you guys think about that. Keep the comments coming. So, back to you, DK.
Thanks, Fionn. Some interesting opinions there. A couple that I do have to shout out. We've actually got a couple from fellow Silver Screen alumni here. And we'll start off with our editor, Nick. Nick said, as a somewhat geeky and awkward computer game playing kid, I loved Tron when it was released. It was right up my street. Frankly, as a somewhat geeky and awkward game playing 50-something, it still is. I'm willing to admit my favourable opinion of the film is coloured by enjoying it all those years ago. It was hugely influential at the time, not necessarily for its storytelling, but for what it meant for the future of filmmaking, inspiring many who would go on to do big things in the industry, including Pixar's John Lasseter, who took not just the concept of computer-generated movies, but also the idea of things having feelings. Some of the acting is a little awkward and quite broadly played, but particularly Jeff Bridges and David Warner do convincing work with a fairly silly plot and some pretty ripe dialogue at times. It's definitely better not to think too hard about what I will generously refer to as the science, but for me, it's always a good time, even now. I find it easily rewatchable, and it has a wonderfully stylish aesthetic. It was incredible at the time, honestly, and the little guys win against the big, uncaring corporation, which I'm always down for. End of line. Yeah, that was from Nick. I've also got one from Mike, and Mike says, and bear in mind, this is Mike's opinion, so, you know, put the pitchforks away, dudes. All right, it's aged like milk, and it works largely because computer tech was such a mystery when it was made, a new and exciting, unknowable thing. But it also has such charm in that wonder, where the basic effects are kind of what gives you that, and one reason why I do not like the upgraded, more soulless look of the sequel. The story is pretty basic good versus evil stuff, with the acting equally serviceable, although Bridges and the legendary David Warner stand out even against dodgy costumes and effects. What is groundbreaking is the story ideas. They may not seem too exciting now, but this film inspired everything from The Matrix to Ultraman. And honestly, it may look like a feature-length previs now, but at the time, the realization of these ideas really was cutting-edge and mind-blowing. Objectively, I can see how it probably won't impress younger generations, but it just captured the imagination of those of us who had a pre-internet childhood. It's fun, has imagery that's become iconic, doesn't outstay its welcome at a breezy 90 minutes, and just feels like revisiting a comfortable old friend and a pleasant memory. And he also finishes with end of line. But yeah, I mean, thank you to everybody who took the time to let us know what they think. And if you're slapping, you know, your hands to either side of your face, scream like because you didn't get your thoughts to us on time, never fear. Either let us know in the comments or on our socials. We're always listening. As always, the links to any of them, and there are a few, is in the description. So with that in mind, we approach the final boss. That is our conclusion. And you know how this one works by now, folks. We go around and ask each of our guests their final thoughts on the movie and their score out of 5 for this one. I'm going to come to you first, Glenn. So what are your final thoughts and score out of 5 for this one?
It may sound a little bit overblown, but because of the history I share with the film, it's got to be a 5. I saw it when it was first released. It won me over instantly. I watched it again this morning to refresh my memory. It doesn't look any older. It still looks sharp. It still looks beautiful. And it's not weighed down by any pretensions. It just moves at a wonderful pace. Everybody does a cracking job. It's just a joy to watch, a repeated watch. I love this film.
Nice one. RW, what about you?
I mean, I agree exactly. I mean, again, being a Jeff Bridges fan for most of my life and then seeing this and, you know, just the colors and the, you know, just everything that we've already talked about, the performances, the visuals, you know, the design, everything worked. And it's amazing that, you know, 3 different early CGI companies. So it was all these different companies working together. And even though it was different design companies, it all worked together that you couldn't tell that it was a different company doing it. But it just blended really well. And again, although it's my second favorite movie of all time, it is my most watched movie of all time. So it gets the number one spot as far as that goes. But, you know, it's just, I don't know. I just think everybody's performance was spot on, and it's what the world needed then to get us here. And if that movie had been made with better CGI, I don't know if it would have been as cute as a movie, or I don't know the word I'm looking for, but I don't think it would be the, you know, if it was too much CGI, I don't think it would, we wouldn't appreciate it as well as we do now. It was exactly what it needed to be. Nothing less, nothing more. It was exactly what we needed, and it worked.
Okay, score out of five then?
Yeah, oh, sorry, yeah, five. It'd be like a 10, but five it is.
Nice one. Cinema can be a very personal thing, so much so that it can occasionally be difficult to remain objective. This is one of those times. I can fully appreciate that this may not be perfect to everyone, but flaws aside, it is perfect to me. As a young gamer completely hooked on my Atari 2600, this was everything. Yes, Luke Skywalker and Flash Gordon may have been larger than life heroes, but Kevin Flynn was the hero I could identify with, a hero I could be, and the dude was as hooked on gaming as I was. To see him played by Jeff Bridges was a revelation, but it's not just Jeff. The cast, though small, is exceptional and made me a Box Lightner and Warner fan for life. Tron is the Spartacus of the video game world, and I was all in. In fact, I think the first thing I ever wrote or attempted to was a sequel to this thing just a couple of days after seeing it. The look is still unique, and while dated in some respects, it's still unmatched in others. That light cycle sequence still takes my breath away. Yes, the plot may lag occasionally, but I honestly just don't care. And coupled with that sublime Wendy Carlos soundtrack, to me, it's one of the all-time greats. I love it wholeheartedly. We had a guest on earlier in the year who stated of the movie he was reviewing that he just loved to be in that world. Well, that's Tron for me, and that's why, objectivity be damned, I am giving this one my first ever cult classics 5 out of 5.
Yeah.
And finally, we'll come to, Jen, can I have your conclusion and score out of 5, please?
I would give it a 5. I feel bad that I didn't know about it until the second movie came out, but it still holds up. Even thinking about how computers are even smaller than they were today than they were back then, they were, you know, fill a whole room back then. It's still valid. I mean, you still have the whole thing of figuring out an entire world that exists inside of technology. It's cool, and I like it, and I like video games, so it's kind of a neat mesh. Yeah, that's what I think of the movie.
Nice one. Which, not hard to see, adding everyone's score together. It might be controversial, but it gives Disney's Tron the first ever cult classic perfect score of 5 out of 5. So, I will say it is another one of those that, despite not being a smash hit at the time, it has stood the test of time for better or worse. The fact that they're still returning to the well over 40 years later shows there's something to the idea that Lisberger had all those years ago. And yeah, that's it. We've reached the end of the line for this one. That's been so overplayed. Thank you to you out there for joining us in our own little world. We hope you've enjoyed it this time around. Once more, all that's left to do is thank my guests on this one, beginning with you, RW. Appreciate you joining us, man.
It was good. I next time I'll make sure I work out all the bugs that I didn't know I was going to have, if there is a next time, and I would join you guys again because this was really fun, and I appreciate you inviting me onto this.
No worries. Glad you enjoyed yourself. We always ask our guests if they've got anything they'd like to draw attention to while they're here. Have you got anything you're working on? Any social media where they can find you?
So if you go to the IMDb and type in R.W. Martin, I'm R.W. Martin (2), because R.W. Martin (1) was a chopper pilot in like Lethal Weapon or something, and that ain't me. and you can see all the stuff I've done, all the stuff that's coming up, and you can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/VT, like Victor Thomas Actor 007. So VT Actor 007, facebook.com, and then that VT Actor 007 is everywhere else, Instagram, TikTok, Twitter, wherever. You just find me as VT Actor 007.
Nice one. Glenn, thanks as always, dude. It's been a blast. We don't get much of a chance to speak these days, so when we do, it's a real pleasure.
It is wonderful, as always. An absolute pleasure. Nice one.
Anything you want to tell the listeners about while you're here?
I know. Again, I'm just playing video games, reading books, and watching films. Just the
much like me, then. No worries on that. So, yeah, that's it. You out there, you know our socials. You're always welcome to hit us up if you want to talk about movies, this one in particular, or perhaps the new one in production. I'd especially like to see you in our Facebook group where we discuss all things film-related. And don't forget our Ko-fi account for those feeling generous. please feel generous. And, yeah, if you out there enjoyed this one, then please like, subscribe, and consider joining us in our upcoming episodes. We'd be honoured to have you with us. Cult Classics will be returning for one last episode this season at the beginning of next month as we head to New York for the gathering. So, yep, grab your choppers and come with us as we finally get to the much-requested Highlander. I will see you there, Spanish, inverted commas, accent and all. Until then, take care, programs, watch out for that extra life token, and remember, there are no problems, only solutions.
You have been listening to the Cult Classics Show, part of the Silver Screen Podcast, created, written, and hosted by TK, produced by Mike Wilson, editing by Nick, feedback section produced by Lady VN, opening credits by Ian Sanderson, music by Timeless Journey. Follow us on social media. Links to all of our social media pages can be found on our link tree. This podcast is part of the Mike's Podcast Network, available wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Silver Screen Podcast or Mike's Podcasts. And don't forget to like, subscribe, and share. Thank you for joining us. We hope to see you next time. And remember, no matter where you go, there you are.